Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I'm your host, John Schmidt, and today, as always, I'll be taking you out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures. It's great to be back, and I'm coming to you this week from Oslo, Norway. I've been here for several days. I spent the last few days, actually, at a conference center, a little village south of Son, which is on the fjord south of Oslo. Lovely setting and a beautiful place to see the sun. And I must say, it seems as if this time of year the sun never sets. And in some respects, likewise, I've felt that way with some of our conversations on Zoomed over the last 6 weeks that we didn't want them to set. It seems like many of them we wanted more time and more light of day to explore the topics and the richness in our guests. And I suspect we'll have the same thing today. But last week, just to refresh again, those of you that were with us and those that have not, we had David Martin. He gave us a very riveting and sobering view of many of the financial and dollar realities we face. And he actually launched us forward, I think, into today's conversation, and really much into a realm of thinking about the importance of community and how coming shifts that we might have need to begin really close to home with some intimate and personal conversations and reflections about the nature of our community and our livingness and where we do live in community. And we explored with David last week three elements, one around the realities, second around foresight, and third around resilience. And in many respects, through the conversation last week, also reinforced the perspective that Zoomed has been echoing since its inception, that we are very likely at the edge of an era of extraordinary change and potentially a fundamental transformation in the evolution of our way of living and mankind itself. And today we want to take David's cue, and we want to launch directly into this conversation about community. I'd love to see how we can build greater understanding about it, recognize some of the realities about what we've created to this point, look forward to future possibilities, and explore the nature of resilience, where we ended last week. How might we fare in the near term amid big shocks coming, and how should we design for the long haul to realize rich, vibrant, and abundant futures? And with that, I'm really delighted my guest today, the insightful, the distinguished Jeb Brugmann, and many of you will know his name by what I represent in terms of some of his writings, but he's a prominent, internationally recognized urbanist, practitioner, and thinker on strategy and innovation, author of the 2009 book, I Think That You'll Love, Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World. Jeb's also published, and many of you business folks that listen in probably have seen it, in a Harvard Business Review, and he also won the 2007 award for the best article, and that article was with C.K. Prahalad, Co-Creating Business's New Social Compact. I think it was a great article, too. I think that we'll even see more of that from Jeb. Maybe a little bit more just to fill it out. Writes in many other ways and dimensions, several other books in sustainability as a contribution, but from a practical sense. I think more about it from Jeb helps local communities access the benefits of globalization and likewise global organizations as they're engaging in local communities and markets. Rich experience, worked on the ground in cities and rural regions in 28 countries. He's founded and served as the chief executive of major international organizations, as well as a faculty member of universities of Cambridge's Program for Sustainability Leadership. Actually, I can go on and on and on with this most impressive background. And little known fact that I must add here, he's also a trekker at the age of 16 on the Appalachian Trail here in the U.S., a 2,000-mile trek in the eastern U.S. for those that are in the rest of the world. Can only imagine, Jeb, what a rich reality that must have been and grounded you in the contributions you've been making. Let me just give you a big welcome to Zoomed. I'm really psyched to have you on with us today, so thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. And that you're right. That trek, what a training that was in resourcefulness and resilience. The topic we'll talk about today.
Well, that's great. I'm sure it was. I'd love to have a conversation by that alone for that. But if we could, I'd love to get into this the whole realm of community. And I've actually been struck in thinking about our conversation while I've been here in Norway, and been very struck in my several trips here in Oslo with a very vibrant sort of living community, and contrasting some of what I saw as I've been online or on the web over the week about some of the publicity again, about some of the talk of bulldozing Flint, Michigan. So quite a contrast in perspectives. Maybe a place to start is, so what's going on with our communities and some of our urban environments?
Well, I mean, if we contrast Oslo and Flint, Michigan, of course, the big difference is kind of a macro one, that they have a booming oil industry and we have a declining automobile industry. But I think the issue of resilience is how we build our communities in such a way that they can absorb these shocks and actually retain their functions and identity and renew themselves. And there are many neighborhoods in the old industrial part of North America that have gone through this process of renewal because of the way they were built and the way in which community was built in them. And then there are many that didn't. And I think the lessons in resilience are, what did we do right in some places and what did we do wrong in others?
Well, so that's a good question then. So there's some things we're doing right and doing some things wrong. What's kind of at the heart of this, Jeb, as we're thinking about communities and where we live and what is going right or wrong?
Well, I think, you know, the if I were to set it up as kind of a polar discussion, and you know, one can think of this as, you know, two extremes for the sake of discussion, the resilient communities, the ones that have this power of renewal, are communities that grew organically. They were self-organized, generally around an industry, some manufacturer or a cluster of manufacturers. And the way they were designed and built and governed and co-located activities was determined by a community itself. It was a group of investors that went from all the way from the workers who built houses and the retailers who built retail and the manufacturers who built the retail. They created a little kind of ecosystem, and we have neighborhoods. Chicago is a place, actually, where you find a lot of these neighborhoods. It went through this deep, deep depression when manufacturing collapsed after World War II and moved to the suburbs, and then it just picked itself right back up. All those run-down neighborhoods where the slumlords had come in and the arsonists had come in and burned half of it to the ground, but they just built themselves right up, and you know, people credit the current mayor, Richard Daley, for a lot of that, but he just picked up on the momentum of a lot of community-based renewal to rebuild that city. But on the other hand, we have neighborhoods that actually are the first legacy of a form of city building that was actually driven by a national government agenda. It was, you know, that expanding our cityscape in the United States through suburbanization, all based on a set of fiscal subsidies for housing, for infrastructure. And so we built a kind of urban form that didn't have an economic logic of its own. It was dependent on a set of subsidies. And as we've sort of scaled it up and made it more cost-intensive and capital-intensive, we've made our country, which is an urban nation, you know, about 83% of people in the United States live in urbanized areas, we've built our country on an extremely fragile economic foundation that's dependent on, you know, a small range of conditions at which it can thrive, and you get about outside of that zone, and the thing kind of falls apart. And of course, we're suffering that with our financial crisis today.
And so you're really describing that the ecosystem sense of it feels very different than something that a suburban environment. It almost feels as if the difference between something alive and something sort of with a heart and something that doesn't have it. I mean, as you're describing, that's kind of what's coming to me. What characterizes this sort of self-organizing sense about what's really making those communities work? There's a financial side, there's an economic side, but is there something else that's going on there too, Jeb?
It's interesting. I'm going to sound maybe a little reductionistic in saying this, but actually around the world, based on my studies, the real driver of the growth of a city is an economic logic. But it's economics in a way that empowers people. So it's not economics just in terms of a crude monetary sense. And there's a set of economic fundamentals to a city contrasting with any other kind of settlement, a suburb or a rural settlement, that are give advantage to the people who settle there. It provides a place for them to, so that they can pursue their strategy, whether it's to advance the condition of their family or of their tribal or caste community or of their business community. The city provides them, number one, with what I call economies of density. And a density in a city provides a highly efficient cost structure because you can co-locate activities and reduce your logistics costs. And it drives down the cost of infrastructure because you don't have to move materials and you don't have to use as much energy to move materials around. So your basic cost structure is much lower. The second economic driver of city is scale economy. So you can distribute the fixed costs and the known risks of any activity over a larger group of people. The third one's a bit more mysterious, which is when you get a lot of different kinds of people, so lots of people meaning scale, and clustered together in a dense form, they can co-organize with one another. They can associate and collaborate in all kinds of new ways that weren't possible for them when they lived in a less dense, smaller community. So I call that economies of association or economies of collaboration. And then when you've got this sort of efficient cost structure provided by scale and density, and then organized groups of people who have found a common cause on the basis of typically some economic strategy they have in common, you have the demand economies and the supply economies for infrastructure. And so suddenly we build ports, and we build telephone systems, and we build airports, and we build road systems, and we build the internet. All of these things are urban infrastructures that allows one group that's figured out how to do something cool in one city, like the pork belly traders in Chicago who, you know, created a commodity exchange, to connect up with other cities and expand their strategy in other cities. And before you know it, we've got a global system of cities. And that's the world we're growing into. We're about halfway to transforming our planet from, one that was known as, sort of nature and a rural-based economies to an urban ecology and an urban-based economy. By 2050, we'll have about 70% of the world's people living in that global urban system. So it's really those basic economic advantages of the city, which are kind of a public good. And if you're a poor person who moves into a slum or a corporation that's setting up a headquarters somewhere else, you're basically playing the same game. You're leveraging those core economics of the city in order to advance your strategy. And of course, people use economics to do all kinds of great things that are liberating for them. It's not just, as I said, just a cash in the account type thing.
Well, Jeff, this is terrific. I think the economic logics really strikes home with me, and I think that's why I've been really interested in having you follow where we've been in our conversations with the economic system and the financial system and all of that that we've been talking about over the previous weeks and the link. This feels to me like it's such an appropriate conversation for us to understand more and what's happening and where this might be moving. But we're up on a break now. Jeff, let's continue this when we come back, and I'd like to explore a little bit more and make that connection and continue and bring some of what we've been talking about into the forefront and what actually might be occurring, how we might even be expecting or see how some of these cities might be responding to some of what's coming. We'll be back here on Zoomed with Jake Brugman and John Schmidt in just a minute. This is Zoomed Leadership. Join us again.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Amanda, age 3. Carlos, age 9.
An abducted child is everyone's child.
Jada, age 14.
To get free Amber Alerts on your cell phone, go to wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, we're back on Zoomed Leadership. Zeb Brugman is joining me, and we're talking about community. And as I was talking about before the break here, Jeb, I'm connecting back to some of our conversations with Chris Martinson and talking about some of the financial realities. And we've been talking about the economic system, and last week with David Martin, we're talking about sort of this boom bust and where we've been. Where are we heading? Are we heading back into the boom? And how can our communities get there with the kind of approach that we have been really utilizing?
Well, we're right at the moment now in the United States where, you know, the debate is going to be, are we going to stick with the trajectory we're on with the form of urbanization and city building that we developed after World War II, which is primarily a semi-urban model, a suburban model, or are we actually going to accept our true nature is that the United States is an urban nation, and we will thrive if we develop very robust forms of what I call urbanism. And urbanism is something more than just building. It's the way that communities of people design urban spaces to advance their strategy, whether it's to create their competitive advantage or to meet some objective like, you know, sustainability or equity. So, you know, in the early United States, we came and settled our country with European traditions of urbanism, the tradition that makes Oslo such a vibrant and robust place today. And we built these mixed-use, relatively dense, multifunction urban centers that had enough of a mix of uses that they could take their shocks and they could adapt. And we still have many places, like I said, in the states that, particularly in the northeast of the U.S., the old U.S., that are built like that. But we've gone towards a model where we increasingly standardize and reduce our new urban spaces to a set of, you know, half a dozen models, basically. We've got strip malls and big box malls and suburban subdivisions. It's kind of a standard batch production of urban space that's delivered to us as passive consumers. So, you know, we're disempowered by this. We're not designing it for our ends at all. We're just sort of getting a basic utility out of it. I know at a certain price I can live there. And this is a very transient urban society that we've created. People aren't investing in it themselves. And that in the last boom bust, the one we're licking our wounds from right now, we moved from standardized production of American cityscape to commodified production. In other words, a vast amount of the new city spaces we were building, we weren't even building them to use them. And let me give you a killer fact on this. In 2005, total housing production in the United States exceeded new household formation by 60%. So what does that tell you? It tells you we weren't building because someone wanted a house. We were building because someone wanted to speculate in a house. And
right.
We commodified our city. So I think we've actually hit the wall. I mean, when we take the heart of what we are as a nation, which is an urban nation that depends on its productivity, on the way we build our cities, and we turn it in, reduce it to a commodity, we're really undermining ourselves as a country, both in terms of our resource efficiency and economics.
So what's an example, Jeb? I mean, how can we pick an example city where this has been maybe even a showcase of that represents the kind of building you're talking about in this commodification? And, I mean, how could we, what are we likely to see if we see some shocks coming our way?
Well, we've seen the shock on the New Edge City. I mean, it's interesting. So we all know the image of Levittown. It was a very affordable entry-level house for people who came out of the Great Depression, and of course there was a baby boom after the Depression, you know, to get in the market, to get an asset which they could leverage into wealth as a family and put their kids through university. So that was the American dream. And what we've been doing is, to a large extent through subsidy, is increasing the size of that and the plant and equipment. I mean, if you think of these edge city houses now that are suffering from foreclosure, whether it's on the edge of Metro Chicago or Las Vegas or in California or in southern Florida, these, we call them starter mansions now, don't we? I mean, they have swimming pools and tennis courts and central vacuuming and air conditioning systems. I mean, these are, and they're located farther and farther away from employment. So the overall cost structure of this stuff is enormous. And so there's this incredible sunk capital investment in our country in a form of city that has minimal productivity to it. We don't create wealth in these places. They're, you know, a kind of, you know, high-end barracks in many respects, which is why we can talk about tearing them down, because they don't create wealth. They just add to the cost structure of our country. And, you know, so that's the challenge side. The good news side, it's quite interesting. I like to talk about Silicon Valley, which was, you know, a place that accepted that suburban model, both in terms of residential suburbs and an auto-dependent transportation system and these corporate campuses that are where the land is mostly parking lot. It's more parking lot than building. And because of this, the industry in Silicon Valley has been suffering because it's losing its competitive advantage. It's got an incredibly high cost structure relative to its international competitors, let's say India. The productivity of its employees is going down because they're stuck in traffic. They can't collaborate so well with one another because of distances. And so the business community, the municipalities, the trade unions, the civic organizations in Silicon Valley are organizing together. There's actually an organization called Joint Venture Silicon Valley to create a new urbanism for that region that provides the new efficiency and the new kind of, you know, in lifestyle that's needed in order for that industry to remain competitive. And they're doing this in two ways. They're creating a new kind of downtown centers where they're moving out of these old campuses into a core district called innovation districts, and they're transforming their, you know, big automobile corridors into kind of corridor urbanism where they've got, you know, retail and commercial and offices along the road corridor, providing transit along the way. So we're going to see in Silicon Valley a significant transformation over the next 10 or 15 years into a kind of urbanism that kind of goes back to our roots as a country, that is going to look more and more like Oslo and less like Levittown.
So you're talking to, that's a great example, Jeb. You're talking about somebody who's actually taking the model that's not working and turning it into something that has the economic logic and really doing that. What are the characteristics of what they're doing? There's the approach and so forth, but what are they doing relative to the people side, the human ecosystem? I mean, are they bringing people together in a way to have these levels of conversations in a different form than are happening in other communities?
Well, the first thing they're doing is my book, Welcome to the Urban Revolution, really focuses on what I call urban strategy, which is, you know, what do you need to do in a metropolitan area to be able to really shape its growth, to transform it into what you would like to normatively like it to be, whether you want it to be a sustainable region or a competitive region or a more equitable region. We always have in our cities these goals, and we put them in plans, and we put the plans on the shelves. But some cities have figured out actually how to dramatically transform themselves, and they're in the process of doing that in Silicon Valley. And the first step in that is they have an alliance between all these interests that I mentioned, in which they figure out how to design the built city space that allows each of those interests with their very different strategies. You know, the trade unions and the high-tech industry and the municipalities might have very different objectives going into that, but they've created a forum where they can figure out how to align their strategies and build that aligned strategy, which is what I call this new urbanism in its two forms, along corridors and within these innovation districts. And creating institutions like Joint Venture Silicon Valley, provide the machinery that supports that alliance, which in effect is kind of a political alliance, to develop all of the many solutions that are needed, the new innovations that are needed in urban design and in urban finance and in urban service provision. And so if you go to the Joint Venture Silicon Valley website, you'll see they've got one group looking at disaster management and another one at looking at how to reduce the CO2 emissions of the region and another one figuring out how to rebuild the corridors. It's kind of a design laboratory for the new city, the new metro that they're trying to build. And then that generates a new set of practices, and you bring in the developer industry, and you actually recreate your developer industry to be able to bring to market the kind of urbanism that you have, this alliance has actually developed. And the cities that I study and the cases are written about in my book are cities that have actually gone through this process, starting with alliance, creating institutions in which to generate innovations, creating a body of practice, and then recreating or creating a new developer industry, a new business segment that can deliver these goods to market, rather than just depending on the standardized products that now globalized construction development companies are putting down around the world in a cookie cutter fashion. So we're moving from standardized production of new city spaces to a user-centered design or customized production of new city spaces, because that's how we achieve our purposes in a world that's being reorganized into a global city, in effect.
And what was the impetus for these groups and for Silicon Valley to do this? What was it that they started to see, Jeb? And we got a couple of minutes left on this segment. We can pick it up later. But what was the genesis out of this? Was there a problem in response, or was this an awareness that people were beginning to see that the life and the style of it didn't seem to be in sync with where they wanted to go? What was it behind it?
Well, I think Richard Florida, in his writings, has picked up on one part of it, is that they needed to attract talent, and it became not a very cool place and very livable place to live in, because it was congested in an atomized society where people are stuck in these suburban residential barracks, in effect. I mean, I'm sounding extreme, and I'm sure people love their suburban residential communities in many cases. But in effect, it became an unattractive place for young people to move to. It wasn't providing the urban living experience that the new employees wanted. Secondly, like I said before, the costs are enormous. Number one, low density means more cost for providing water, for providing electricity, for providing any kind of service, for providing transportation or transit. So the cost structure is high relative to your global competition. India is coming up. Bangalore is coming up. So they've got to compete against that kind of a cost structure. And then productivity is declining because you're stuck in traffic. You're spending hours of your day on the road. And I'm sure there are many other things, but it was sort of that sense that whatever it was that made this a creative place that attracted talent and allowed that talent to collaborate, it wasn't that anymore. This suburban model, when it was scaled up across the region, just didn't provide those, dynamics and those functions any longer. It wasn't working at that scale.
So, Jeb, that raises two thoughts to me. One is that those of us, and I, certainly in Atlanta live in a suburban environment myself, so one side of it is just actually living there and what to expect and what is the realm of what we could affect with some of these shocks and what is it that we're actually going to experience. And the second is, and given the nature of the experience How might that actually be turned into something positive, so that as we're experiencing that, how that is could be actually be an impetus that we could begin to exercise leadership individually and collectively as we can influence others to start having some impact in changing the communities we have here. And so maybe we can pick up that on the next segment. But I am curious about what you think the net impact might be of some of the shocks that we've been talking about and what could be coming. We're talking about a continuing financial shock and what might happen there, dollar fall, dollar crash, the ripple effect, some further effects relative to real estate, the continued fall. We talked about some oil shocks that Chris Martinson was talking about, peak oil and some of the prices, although that we're not running out of oil, but we could have see this up and down pattern. I'm curious about the net effect of that, and then we can build forward into the potentiality and build for that into the future. Come on back in a few minutes. Jeb and I will continue the conversation. You're on Zoomed Leadership. I'm John Schmidt. Jeb Brugman, we'll be right back.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
I will not pass gas in my house. I will not pass gas near my spouse. I will not pass gas in your face, because the gas I pass is worse than mace. A silent but deadly cloud of toxic waste. The end. Secondhand smoke contains hydrogen cyanide and other lethal gases. Don't pass gas, take it outside. Get the facts at don'tpassgas.org. A message from the American Legacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, we're back here on Zoomed with Jeb Brugman, and we're continuing our conversation about communities and how, in fact, we've been building them, and we're going to build forward. And Jeb, as I was asking before the break here, what might we expect with some of this model that has not been working? What might we expect here or even globally, either one? What kinds of experiences might really be coming forward to us?
Well, I think the shock that we're experiencing now is just a little dress rehearsal for what we could be experiencing. It's we feared it would be a much worse crisis than it is. There's still financial things we have to recover from, but it's not the crisis that we might be experiencing in 20 or 30 years, in particular because of the transition in global energy. So, you know, with peak oil coming on, with a shortage of a carbon-based economy upon which all of this suburbia is dependent, we're going to continue the basic, you know, profit and loss statement of this kind of living is going to become less and less viable. transportation cost goes up. So, you know, then this whole issue of whether these communities can transform themselves into something that, you know, is more self-contained in terms of its economy becomes a challenge. And it's a big challenge because these are very capital-intensive places. When I ride around the edge cities, the new edge cities of Toronto, and look at the scale of investment in the big box model and these starter mansion models, there's so much sunk cost there that I think it's hard to go back and say there's something that we can tear down and make something new of, or, you know, that we can actually adapt it to some other form. It's all based on economies of scale. And so how you add to that, you know, what I call the economies of density that allow different activities to be co-located together in a much more efficient way becomes a big financial challenge for the developer community and for the municipalities. So we may find people just abandoning places, and perhaps that's what we're already seeing now. And then added to that, the other issues related to climate change in terms of more global migration. There's going to be hundreds of millions of refugees from coastal areas that are inundated, and we're already seeing this. I mean, of course, the physics of the expansion of water as oceans warm is an irrefutable fact, and oceans are already expanding. And on the California coastline in San Francisco, they're already seeing sea level rise in inundation. In fact, it was already 20 years ago that they saw salinization of freshwater supply in the Bay Area, and they've had to change infrastructure to deal with that already, and now they're seeing flooding in areas all along the San Francisco Bay. So we're going to see a lot more of that, people moving around a lot more and looking for new settlements. So that's very disruptive. At the same time, the growth of urban areas that's going to come and the movement of people towards more efficient urban areas gives us a tremendous opportunity to learn how to do urbanism in a more efficient and in a more, you know, resilient and robust way.
And Jeb, I know we've talked about this some, that there's a natural sort of almost an Aikido move here, that we're really moving more and more to an urban environment. And in the conversations we've had, you've really suggested that there's really a new way to think about it with the new model and with the new urbanism or the urbanism you're describing here. It's really shifting the way we think about cities and a paradigm about that, whether it's Silicon Valley or more. Can you say a little bit more about that, about how we might be thinking about cities differently than we have?
Well, let me start. I'll give you an answer on that from a very different starting point. I think this is about national identity, first and foremost. It's about national culture. We have wrestled with our reality as an urban nation for a long, long time. Most people, we have these national myths of the pioneer nation, of Jeffersonian pastoralism, then we've got the environmental movement and the, you know, John Muir and Henry David Thoreau point of view, the Norman Rockwell point of view of small town life, and it came up in the last election, this notion of, you know, there's this vast number of Americans that live in these small towns, what we call Main Street on some of the cable TV stations. Mm-hmm. So we have this mythology of ourselves as being this kind of rural small town country, but the fact of the matter was, at the turn of the 20th century, in other words, in the year 1900, 70% of the people who were immigrating to the United States were settling in cities of the United States. It's been a long time that our country has been predominantly an urban country in terms of its centers of culture, its centers of economic life, and its centers of politics. And then we had this federal government intervention post-World War II to create this new kind of suburban model. And we're going to have to come back to that, you know, more economic model. So As a nation, we have to wrestle with our sense of aversion to urban life, or the sense that being dense with a lot of people, somehow that's a negative. And, you know, of course, there's been a lot of racial issues behind that escape from the city to the suburb. It seems like we've healed that a bit, that we can actually live with one another, live close to one another. We don't have to segregate according to racial and ethnic groups so much. So I think we're in the process of going through that, and it's in the, you know, the creation of an identity as an urban country, as a place with vibrant urban spaces, that we're going to discover these solutions. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm hopeful because I'm seeing it all over. One can call what's happened in Washington, D.C., gentrification, but there's no question there's been an incredible renewal there, increasing the density of downtown D.C., making new investment. You know, there's an incredible vitality there. You're seeing it now on Broadway in Manhattan, the renewal of Broadway. We've seen the rise of Chicago again on the Pacific West Coast. We see Seattle, Kings County, Portland being leaders in entirely new kind of urbanism. So the United States is becoming a very vibrant place in terms of experiments and new kinds of urban development.
So, yeah, it's interesting, Jeb. You're really pointing to where we've often talked about on the show. There's the front of life and the back of life, and there's the actual tangible form in the cities we're living. But what you're suggesting is that we're thinking about it differently, a new mindset, a different orientation to it, and out of that, a different identity in terms of who we are with each other. And it feels like you're even describing the way we are with each other is actually changing, and recognizing that we're really much in a greater sense together and potentially interdependent, and that livingness that goes with it.
Well, and I think that happens. And, you know, again, not to reduce things to economics, but when people have to live more at the margin, they become more interdependent on each other. And, you know, we are doing that. I mean, this crisis, we all know, has sort of changed the energy we put into increasing our consumption as a way in which we develop to how we experience and live together. And I see this in many ways. I hear stories all the time. A colleague of mine in the Pacific Northwest talked about in his community there was an old school that I can remember someone had an idea of developing it into some kind of an institutional facility, but the community decided, no, you know, this school and the grounds around it is actually our park, and it's where it's the kind of core of our community. So can we make it a health center? Can we, you know, make it a place where seniors live, so that people can actually grow old in that community and then be cared for within the community in a seniors home? So the community is kind of taking ownership of what was otherwise just some public institutional building and turning it into a community asset. And I think this is happening all over North America. It's happening in my neighborhood here in Toronto. And, you know, that's what happened in the Great Depression as well. I remember my grandparents telling me with a sense of almost good old days that during the Depression they had the Victory Gardens and people sort of came together and they had a life that was lost when they got into that sort of post-war baby boomer suburban expansion mode. And perhaps we're going through that one more time, but now we're doing it with a lot of lessons about what kind of city actually is competitive and vibrant and ecologically sustainable. And we've got all these experiments we've done, and I think those lessons are going to be fed into this sort of social transformation that's happening within our country as well.
Well, you're really describing to me just a form of connectedness with others, and the way that we're beginning to embrace and own and take care of communities and people in our cities in a different way. I mean, it almost feels very much, Jeb, like a developmental sort of step forward, that as we're growing developmentally, we grow, we get more, embrace more of a full view and a sense of wholeness and a sense of connection. I hear you describing some of that with the way our cities are shifting and moving, that really feels like it's in somewhat just an evolutionary shift of who we are as human beings at the same time.
It is, and I think it's important to realize that the city, as a designed, built place with infrastructure in it, is essential to support that process. The spaces we create for ourselves and how they define the way we can interact and the cost associated with our interacting and doing things together, they define the possibility of our culture and who we can be for each other. I think that's the great urbanist revolution we're heading into, is people figuring out, and I call it user communities because, you know, that's how we think about it from a business point of view, in terms of industrial engineering of a new product. When we want to do product innovation, we think about you know, not so much let's give them what we think is good for them, but we go back to the users and we have them engage in designing the new product that they most want with the functionalities and experience that that user group wants. And I think that same concept now needs to be applied to the way we design and build our cities, that we need to change the development process so that communities actually can come together like in Silicon Valley and they can say, you know what we need for the next 20 or 30 years and what we aspire to now is something different, and let's come up with 100, 200,000 new solutions we need that will allow us to transform our built spaces into a place that supports that. And what a key thing here that differentiates urbanism from what you could just call development, right?
Jeff, if we could hold on that one, because I'd like to pick up on this a little bit more, but I think we're just coming up on a break, and
okay.
I didn't want to get too far into that. But you're describing something very interesting to me, that the reflection, our cities are a reflection of who we are, but it also, the way we design it, provides a sense of the potential. So let's, in our last segment, let's really look more at that potential. Continue on your through line that you're continuing there. Come on back, last segment. Jack Brugman, John Schmidt on Zoomed Leadership. We'll be right back.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Do you know who your kids are talking to on the internet? Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, we're back on Zoomed Leadership. Last segment with Jake Brugman. Jeb, let's continue with this. We're talking about the nature of the mindsets and the nature of the transformation and what this might, where this might go, and thinking about the potential, thinking about the possibility for the future. Maybe we can continue that through line and also wrap in more some thoughts about the nature of being resilient and resiliency.
But yeah, I was talking about the transformation that's happened in industry. That industry has moved from standardized production to user-centered production, and in fact, the most, you know, our most creative and admired new business models are business models in which every individual consumer designs the business to work for them. So, if you think about, you know, eBay, for instance, as a model, it's totally consumer-driven, and I think that's where we now need to go in terms of the way we think about the building of our cities, that it needs to become, again, a community-driven process. In the end of the day, that's what resilience comes from, is when there's a group of people who share a common sense of agency, right? They're not passive consumers anymore, just accepting a few choices on a shelf. In a way, you know, the kind of fast food of cities and the convenience that provides, but they're actually engaged in the process of creating a future. And that develops a sense of ownership, and also the people who co-create that new unit of a city together, whether it's that school I mentioned in the Pacific Northwest or a new residential community or a new region like Silicon Valley, because they create it, they identify with it, and they know how it works, and they know how to maintain it, and they know how different shocks to the system are going to impact upon it. But what we have now in our mode as just passive consumers of the next subdivision, we don't really understand what is required to make that tick and to make that work. When we move into that house in the suburb, we don't understand whether there are the social services and facilities that will allow that place, that new place, to evolve into a real community and not just a place where you go to sleep and raise your family kind of on their own. But when we build something together, we have a very deep sense of it, you know, and identification with it. It's a very, very different thing. And I think Americans know this experience. When we talk about Main Street and the small town life that I think, you know, miss now of what we are, because we aren't that anymore, I think we're referring back to a cultural legacy when we had that life, when we lived in communities, when in a way we were villagers and we knew how it all worked together as an ecology. So that's what we're shifting back to. And the question is, can we do that at the same scale that we've built the suburban landscape of the United States? Can we learn how to, from even an industrial point of view, do customization like that at a big scale?
Well, that's an interesting question.
It's a big question.
Yeah. So, what do you think?
Any challenges, and you know, from a business audience point of view, this is a fascinating business question, but it's not a new one. I mean, all other industries have gone through this question. My colleague C.K. Prahalad has written multiple books about it. You know, organized around the concept of co-creation. How do we, as developers, another industry, produce urban product that's designed to a unique community? And yeah, I think we see this in, you know, for instance, in Portland and in the Seattle area, they've changed development process so that they can do this, and they've created a developer community that knows how to do this, and the question is now, can we scale that up?
Well, this is a very compelling view forward, and I'm also just sitting with the notion of some of where our conversations have been, that there's going to be a tendency with some of these shocks to have individuals sort of contract and retract and sort of the tension that can come out of this. But at the same time, we're talking about the potential here, Jeb, and how do we bridge the gap with that, in your sense, that some people and the nature and some of the suburbs and these areas and the cities that are built like this, with some of the difficulties and the difficulties we might find with oil and so forth, how do we bridge the gap from where we are right now forward, and how do we bridge that? And you're describing it with community, but any thoughts about how we really bridge that from a practical standpoint in the near term into the potential that you're describing?
In some ways, maybe it's more simple than we think. I think we bridge it by providing people with an experience of its possibility. And let me give an example from Chicago and Chicago's renewal. And this, Richard Daley does have, deserve a lot of credit for this. When they came out of their crisis, they had thousands of lots of old apartment buildings that had been taken over by slumlords and then burned down to get the insurance proceeds off, you know, by arsonists to get the insurance proceeds off those buildings after they'd been basically asset stripped. So they had these empty lots, which were just places where gangs hung out and there were hazardous places for children and all this kind of thing. And they had to figure out what were they going to do with all the space. And they figured out that if they created an institution called Neighbor Space that was kind of a trustee of these lands and worked with community groups to give them that one place that they could envision together what it would be, whether it'll be a community garden or a new playground or just a park, or they'll build some kind of facility there, and transfer that asset to that community, it became the focus point around which a downtrodden community that was suffering could actually regenerate, could build something new together with that sense of agency and ownership. And when they invested in it, then Neighbor Space, which is a sort of arm's length agency of the city, would transfer the title of the property to the community on, you know, specific terms that it would be maintained in a certain way under an agreement with the city. And now this has been done in hundreds of places in Chicago, and it's expanded the park spaces and inner city neighborhoods in a very important way, not just in terms of the, you know, the square footage of park space, and in terms of the role that a park can play in the regeneration of a community and bringing back life to it. And like that school in the Kings County, Seattle, I think we need to figure out how we can seed that experience in many places, including in our suburban communities that are suffering. And coming back to the notion before that, you know, now they're talking about tearing down all neighborhoods in Flint. You know, that may be the solution, depending on the place. I don't think we should take a single approach to all of it. These may be places where a little bit of resources with a little bit of support to facilitate a process like that allows people to understand the possibility for transformation.
Jeb, I think you've just summarized it well for me that where we left it with David Martin last week was to start and to begin with quiet conversations in our communities, in our homes, to start to connect people. But what you really, to me, have done is put a very tangible sense of what to do, and that is let's build some experiments and look at the possibilities and begin to see how we can build this kind of potential forward. So we're down here just in terms of, a matter of seconds left. Jeb, let me just thank you again. I think this has been a wonderful show. I'd love to continue this conversation with you on a future show. Also, let me mention to people that want to track you down, it's Jeb, J-E-B, Brugman, Brugmann.com. Find Jeb there. Wonderful website, rich with information. Also point you to Jeb's book, Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World. Jeb, thank you very much for joining us here today, and also find his article on co-creating businesses and the new social compact. Jeb, I think we don't have much time here, but a pleasure to have you and your wealth of perspective. Thanks for joining us today. This is Zoomed Leadership. Join me again next week. We'll continue the topic and the flow and the forum for looking forward inside, outside, the front of life, back of life. I'm John Schmidt. Come back. Have a great week. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.